This is an RNZ podcast.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. This week, as megabucks were rolled out for roads and a new plan that rolls back the sums spent on other transport, we look at how some media questioned how this will work, while others seized on stuff that will hardly make a dent in the billion-dollar budget.
No funding at all for speed bumps. No speed bumps in this plan.
Also, penny pinching on post-pregnancy snacks in hospital hit the headlines this week, even after a swift U-turn in the face of a public backlash.
It was like, you know, not a good piece of toast. It was dry and it was thin and I don't even know what it had. I wouldn't even remember what it had on it, but it hit the spot.
But first, we look back at a remarkable week in Te Ao Māori as a Māori monarch was farewelled and a new one anointed. And all this played out at Tūranga Waewae Marae over several days and the longest continuous multimedia coverage of any event in New Zealand history.
Everybody is preparing for the arrival of the king. Anticipation is growing. The warriors are ready. They're preparing themselves. The paddlers are already on their waka and they've already launched themselves onto Waikotoawa. So, ka re roa, ka ki te tatou I ngā huatanga o kone. Hei whakanui, hei whakamānui, te tainga mai o te tūpāpuku o kingi tūheitia ki konei ki te taha o te awa o Waikato.
That was broadcaster Scotty Morrison, along with veteran journalist and presenter Tini Molyneux, on the banks of the Waikato River as the body of Kingi Tuheitia was being escorted to the barge to take him to his final resting place, Taupiri Maunga. And that prompted Scotty Morrison, the presenter of TVNZ's news shows Te Karere and Marae, to recall the last time a monarch was farewelled like this, Te Arikinui Dame Te Aterangi Kahu, back in 2006, when permission was required to make the same journey. But, as Scotty Morrison noted, times have changed.
It was controlled by the council back then, various councils along the riverbanks. But in 2008, there was the Waikato River Settlement, and in that settlement, the request was put in by Waikato Tainui that they had more control over what was happening with Waikato and with the Waikato River. And so this particular time, they don't have to ask for any permission. Yeah. They can just go straight on and say, we're taking our king on the awa at this particular time, close it down.
And that's mana motuhake for you.
Tēnā koe, that is mana motuhake.
And times have changed a lot for the media since then too. For example, Whakaata Māori now has two TV channels which both carried live coverage of the ceremonies over the past 5 days, and the Kingitanga's own channel broadcast live throughout on YouTube and Facebook as well. And another broadcaster who joined that epic broadcast on Friday soon after, Matai Smith, reminded viewers that the notion of media isn't what it was in 2006 either.
We know that we live in a world of TikTok and Instagram. The relevance of the kingitanga to Waikato Tainui, but also to us here in Aotearoa. Many of us could be seen as quite ignorant to the significance of this kaupapa.
And that was a point that Mihi Nārangi Forbes made like this on RNZ's Morning Report, presenting from Tūranga Waewae live on Friday, after Kuini Ngā Wai Hono I Te Pō became the eighth Māori monarch and the second youngest ever anointed.
I had a quick look on the socials because Ngā Wai Hono I Te Pō is 27 years old and the average Māori is also 27 years old. So this is the way that this generation communicates.
And while it was a sombre and ceremonial occasion, it also had moments of levity, both in the speeches at the Pai Pai.
Me rātou hoki, tino hariko, because I'm the last speaker, so you must be pretty happy about that. We can smell the kai cooking somewhere, so I'm not going to let those fellas shake their stick at me and tell me to sit down and hurry up, so I'll be smart about it.
And between broadcasters, having a laugh with their guests in between as well.
E mihi ana hoa tēnā koe. Koi wahi mai koe ki a mātou, ngāri mi parantou mai, no mai. Ki tā koe, mihi noi ane ki te...
Po hea, me makere na mātua.
Ke kia kato kona rukua pana e koe hau.
All this played out at Tūranga Waewae Marae over 5 days, just days after dignitaries and the media had all gathered for the Koronehana, the annual celebration of the coronation of Kingi Tuheitia. And what was to come out of this was not only coverage of an historic moment in Te Ao Māori, but also the longest continuous multimedia coverage of any event in our national media history as well. So how was all this done? Well, one of those in the media pack at Tūranga Waewae throughout was Kawe Rus, former Whakaata Māori presenter, who's now the digital media editor for Wātea News.
Tainui and the Kingitanga already have systems in place to make it easy for broadcasting. In terms of Kingitanga, they've been doing live streams, you know, coming up nearly, 15 years. You know, literally once Tuheitia had taken the throne, he literally became the king of social media because everything he was, where he was going, it was all on a cell phone. There were people following him on the internet. Kingitanga, Koroneihana, and those types of events were able to transition from a special broadcast that might have been done in the TVNZ days to where we were able to do an actual, what we now call live streams. And across those live streams, because the infrastructure was in place, it made the job easy. The hardest part of it all wasn't getting anyone down there, but we had so many people to choose from. Journalists like myself who were versed in te reo and English, you had Māori journalists who were just versed in English. In addition to that, you know, you had our iwi radio networks who were also part of that, with a lot of the younger ones coming through the media landscape. And in my 12 years of broadcasting, I don't think I've ever seen the amount of talent that was put into making sure King Tūheitia had the best broadcast for his tangihanga.
You had this big, well, looked like a very collegial effort of all these people getting together from different networks and coordinating this broadcast. I mean, not just sort of succeeding each other in the broadcast, but crossing to each other and back again with different guests and speakers. Also, you know, I didn't see people making any big deal of any branding from their home networks or anything. Was all that just put aside and it just became this one collective effort?
There was no need to put Wātea up. There was no need to put Māori TV up, because the kaupapa, the broadcast, was more important than the brands. So like for us at Wātea and all that, you know, we had digital signatures rotating around to show brand awareness, but it really wasn't a big thing. You know, the big thing was to make sure that there was a broadcast out there fit for a king, fit for New Zealanders, and fit for the world to observe and watch. The other thing too, and I guess this is for the wider New Zealand to understand, is that even though we're in different organisations, we've either worked with them at some point when we've been working together at Māori TV, or we've seen them at other functions. So we already have a rapport. It was like a big family reunion from my perspective, on the other side of the broadcast, where all of us just came together. We shared all our knowledge. Like, for instance, I was sharing knowledge with Kingitanga, my knowledge of Kingitanga, my knowledge of Tainui Whakapapa, with the New Zealand Herald reporter. You know, there was controversy about New Zealand Herald and Wātea, we're not going to do this with their subscription, this type of stuff. But again, us at Wātea put that kaupapa to the side. I, as a Māori journalist, can't help him, give him the context, help him with the question lines, because that's my trick. That's my understanding of how I can help them. So I understand Tainui, I understand Kingitanga. And if I'm in the room and I'm not helping them, then what am I doing in my job, really? And, you know, he sat with me and he goes, oh, honestly, thank you for that. There's any time, mate. You know, like at the end of the day, we're here to put out an amazing story.
So did it feel like the kaupapa was, you know, broadcasting like in the service of Kingitanga and iwi around the country? Or did you feel, look, that this was really about being the eyes and ears of the people who couldn't be there? Or was it even something different? Like, this was actually a national project. This is part of history. And what you're doing here will be sitting in archives and available, you know, online forever. Which was the overriding sort of mission?
So for us, there was the history making side of it. And because we knew it was going to be a historic moment, we were like, no, we just need to get as much skills down there as possible. I got a call from a close family member within the Kingitanga saying that the late king had passed. So that was at 2:30 in the morning. So for me, from what I could tell, all the broadcasters went down there to ensure there was a quality product. There was quality information. There was quality reo. There was quality English. Concepts and themes were being explained succinctly and clearly. Because if you don't know Kingitanga, if you don't know Tainui, you're going to find it very hard to write, take videos, or talk about. So what I could see is a lot of the journalists, they took all the knowledge pools that were around them and they put out some amazing content. You know, talking about, for instance, when Ngāwe became queen, they were easily able to go and find out all her facts and information, how old she was. Some of us were able to give some personal context about what she had done in Waikato and Tainui over her 27 years from a child to now. And they were all not necessarily singing from the same hymn sheet, but at least were coming from the same pool of knowledge to get the information out there for wider New Zealand.
Now, as you pointed out earlier, Kingitanga has adopted new media, social media, live digital channels. That's also your area. You've been doing that with Wātea. And now that we have a young queen, 27 years old, of that generation, is this going to change, do you think, the approach to covering these issues and, in fact, how she herself interacts? Will it be a channel that the media can use as well as just ordinary people?
It's going to be interesting to see how that goes forward. Ngā Waihonui Te Pō is the boss. She is now the queen of Māoridom. How she wants to roll with tikanga, how she wants to roll with kawa in a digital space, by if that means her taking selfies, that might mean her taking selfies. But, you know, at the end of the day, she'll find what works for her. And from what I can tell, a lot of the status quo will remain. Her grandmother has already given media the example that you can speak to a queen. Her grandmother had spoken to Waka Huia, Marae, and I believe Te Karere during the time of her reign. And it wasn't a major kōrero. My whole thing is we're in a digital space now. The only thing I would suggest is be careful who you're talking to. Not because of what you're going to say, but, you know, we don't want to overuse a majesty and people get hoha listening to her. For us as Tainui, this is my Tainui perspective journalist hat off now, that particular family is well, for us as Tainui, we look at them with a sense of tapu. You don't naturally go up to them and start talking to them. But, you know, for Ngā Wai, there might be things we see where she might be going to, say, for instance, Waitangi. But the other thing that I know about Her Majesty Queen Ngā Waihonui Te Pō is that she is well connected with rangatahi, pakeke, and all generations across Tainui, and she's an easy lady to talk to. It's going to be interesting to see how she shapes kingitanga into this modern age. But at the end of the day, for us here in Tainui, she's the boss, and however she wants to run that tikanga, how she interacts with the rangatahi, the pakeke, and the kaumātua going forward, it's basically up to her.
As we've been learning, if we didn't know already, the kingitanga was a kind of political construction in a way, because it was formed to have a unified kind of front because of the crown, to get a bit of collective ability there. So this is now an issue again, Crown Māori relations, I suppose, has never gone away, but it's kind of at a peak at the moment. Will it be odd for Māori media, Māori journalists to, you know, have to be, you know, dealing with this accession as a kind, in a kind of reverential way, and then it could become a political story where they have to put their political type of journalist hat on and political matters as a voice of Māoridom when things get political? That could change the picture, couldn't it, for Māori media and for the kingitanga?
Well, I think the kingitanga actually changed the media landscape when they started throwing out support for the Māori Party under the reign of King Tūheitia. So we've got an example there on how we can critique and how we can ask questions. But what always happens is that you'll never get to the monarch. You will only ever get to the monarch spokespersons. And that's why you have people like Rahui Papa, Ngira Simmons, who speak one-on-one with the monarch. And then they bring those thoughts to the media in wider New Zealand, either through a media release or through a stand-up. Tainui are across how to deal with media. You know, you have an iwi who have been dealing with crowns for 166 years, from petitions, writing letters to ministers, and this is just another form of where they're going to in the future. So I think it's going to be easy for them, no matter which way they decide to steer their waka and the way they want to do it. The one thing for us as Māori journalists and journalists at whole is that everyone will want to speak to Ngā Waihonui Te Pō. But here's the reality. Nobody's probably going to get it. She's probably not going to be talking for at least the first year. And even if she does talk, it will only be about selected matters. And anything politically charged will be put into certain spokespersons for them to carry the words, for them to carry the kaupapa in the way that they need to, so that the monarch is not in that space. So I see the kingitanga putting up people in places to create that influence and to protect the monarch as it goes forward.
And just finally, Kawe, I heard you speaking with Dale Husband on Waitea earlier in the week. You said I think you're 36 years old now, and said you've had some experience, and even back when Dame Te Rangi Kahu died in 2006, you were covering that too. Does it feel the whole media space is sort of regenerating, and that's reflected in, you know, the age and attitude of younger journalists who are now doing something like this, which is, you know, we've said possibly the longest continuous media broadcast of any kind in New Zealand's history, and they just take it in their stride?
Yep, I'm 36. Technically, I'm still very young, but I've got so many more younger journalists, younger reporters, younger producers coming through. They're far more fluent than me in te reo. They're far more articulate than me in te reo. And for me, I know I've done a great job, and it's time for me to move on. If I continue to take broadcasting roles where I'm facing the public, on screen, on the microphones, then that takes away opportunities for the new ones coming through. My enjoyment with the skills that I have is showing the younger ones, this is the skills I have, take what you want, make it what you want, make it your own, because that's what they deserve. You know, some of us didn't get the training like I did. For me, for Radio Wāwhia and a lot of our other iwi radio network providers, our main focus is getting the next generation of Māori broadcasters out there so they are confident, so they are fluent, and they're just as good as anybody else. My whole thing is, if you're better than me, I'm out, you're in, and that's how we need to go with the next generation.
That was Kawe Rose, digital reporter for Auckland-based urban Māori broadcaster Radio Wātea, part of Te Whakaruruho, O Ngā Reo Irirangi Māori, the iwi radio network, these days a multimedia network as well. Now, Radio Wātea's coverage from Tūranga Waiwai is online at wateanews.com, and the digital content of Kawe and his colleagues can be found on Wātea's social media feeds. Meanwhile, Whakaata Māori has a highlights program available to view on its app and its website, maoriplus.co.nz, and TVNZ's live coverage from the final day of the Tangihanga of Kingi Tuheitia is available on demand and easy to find on TVNZ Plus, while RNZ's coverage and analysis can be found in the Te Ao Māori section at rnz.co.nz.
Right, now, Simeon Brown, I feel like we should be paying him here at ZB. He seems to be on ZB every 5 minutes. Who knew that his portfolio was going to be so significant? Well, he's got a lot of portfolios, I think. But anyway, so speed limits.
That was News Talk ZB's Glenn Hart introducing the network's daily retrospective catch-up podcast, ZBeen, last Monday. And he wasn't wrong about Simeon Brown being in the media an awful lot these days as the Minister of Energy and of Local Government, and most lately as Minister of Transport. Now, on that day, it was his announcement last weekend that he was committed to speeding up our road trips by bumping up some road speed limits that got the Minister airtime.
Do you base these decisions on research, evidence, or just a hunch?
It's based on the design standard that the road was built to. These roads are built to a safe standard of being able to drive at 110 kilometres per hour.
Simeon Brown on last Sunday's Weekend Collective show on News Talk ZB. And he went on to say that going faster on the highways wouldn't be all up to him, though. There would be public consultation. And the next day, ZB's Andrew Dickens didn't seem too keen on that.
We believe in fast-tracking. This government believes in fast-tracking. Why are they doing the whole public consultation process?
What's this asking people what their opinion is? You know what will happen then? All the do-gooders and the fussy fuss will come out and go, no, you can't go that far.
Now, later that same day, the minister was back in the news media with a much bigger plan, the National Land Transport Plan, announced against a backdrop of cars zipping down a Wellington motorway.
Getting transport back to basics is one of the key reasons why Kiwis voted for this government. They were sick of the potholes plaguing our roads. They were fed up with the phantom projects that cost a fortune but never got off the ground. And they were tired of the speed bumps, planter boxes and cycleways that made going about their day-to-day lives all the more difficult.
And there's big money in that plan for the next 3 years, and lots of that will go on roads of national significance, some of which were out under the previous government but are now all back in under this one. There's also a boost for some public transport, but not rail, but funding for active transport, such as walking and cycling, was slashed back by more than half in the new plan. And though the sum spent on cycleways and planter boxes that Simeon Brown mentioned there is absolutely tiny by comparison, it took up a huge amount of the airtime on talk radio. Likewise, those speed bumps, which Heather Duplessy-Allen raised on the ZB Drive show later on Monday with Simeon Brown.
No funding at all for speed bumps. No speed bumps in this plan.
So, we're cutting the funding for speed bumps. In fact, I call it an infestation of speed bumps that we've seen across our roads whilst potholes have been remaining unfilled. So, actually, I want to see that money going into filling potholes.
Yeah. Now, that notion of sticky up speed bumps being repurposed to fill in the sunken potholes played pretty well with motorists and News Talk ZB.
Kiwis are sick and tired of councils up and down this country simply trying to slow them down and cause congestion.
And on ZB last Monday, Heather Duplessy-Allen ended up cheerleading for Simeon Brown like this.
I don't know how true this is, but I'm going to tell you this regardless. I heard the other day that Simeon's nickname in caucus is Golden Balls because the man can't do anything right. Wrong. Oh my gosh, how about getting that story wrong? He can't do anything wrong. He gets everything right. He's the golden boy. And there you go, another announcement where it's the nail on the head.
Well, Simeon Brown did get at least one thing wrong in that announcement of the National Land Transport Plan that day. Brown told reporters 24 speed bumps on state highways had been scrapped at a cost of $500,000 each, so that was $12 million saved, he reckoned. But then the Wellington Daily The Post questioned those numbers with the minister's office, who said the minister was referring to one single project, not on any highway. It's in fact in Auckland's Grey Lynn. Now, we've been there before, right here on Media Watch, in fact. Back in February, Simeon Brown seized on a New Zealand Herald full-page claim that Auckland Transport was pushing on with $500,000 crossings. Now, for this, the Super City reporter at the Herald, Bernard Orsman, had cited just one in Auckland that has traffic lights and where unexpected stormwater issues had pushed up the price tag to that level. But he neglected to mention that the estimated cost of the other raised crossings in the city was between $19,000 and $31,000 each, even though Auckland Transport told Media Watch that they had told the Herald that before the Herald published its story. The Herald did run a small correction to that effect in print the next day, but it seems the minister missed it, along with Media Watch that weekend. Now, that doesn't mean that crossings with signals aren't costly, but 27 of them, planned over 2 years for Auckland, accounted for just 0.5% of AT's annual capital budget of more than $1 billion. Clearly, just a tiny fraction of the national transport budget too, and so are the cycleways that Simeon Brown said, without evidence, people are sick and tired of. Though this caller to ZB in Wellington that day was certainly one of them.
Last week I was waiting for the train on Western Hutt Station. There's a lovely multi-million dollar cycleway just across the rail track, and then State Highway 2. A cyclist went past, pounding on his way to Wellington. Not on the cycle track, on the side of State Highway 2.
Well, you see that all the time.
$40 million was a complete waste of money. And what's worse, a fully illuminated cycleway. So why?
I don't know. You tell me.
Now, that cycleway would have been lit from above for much the same reason as every other roadway and roadside footpath, for the safety of the people using it. Now, that cycle lane that the caller was talking about there is a strip of land between State Highway 2's barriers and the railway line, which can't be used for much else. In fact, it can't be crossed or joined from the highway side either, so that cyclist on the highway that the caller spotted would have started their journey before that section of cycle lane that goes south to Petone. Now, the caller, Colin, wasn't wrong that it was a costly project that ended up way over budget, but so did much of the road building in recent years that had much bigger budgets, not highlighted in the same way by our media. For example, The Post, which pulled up the minister this week for amping up the cost of those speed bumps, reported just 2 weeks ago that Wellington City Council had spent $518 per household on cycleways in just the last 2 years. But Wellington City Council told Media Watch at the same time that the spending the Post had cited was actually borne by households over a number of years, and that half the cost of the bike network came from New Zealand Transport Authority Waka Kotahi. The actual cost per household would be around about $319, the City Council reckoned, while each household paid almost $1,600 for roads in that time and $3,800 for transport in total. In 2024, the bike network, including related bus and pedestrian improvements, was roughly 8% of the council's total land transport budget, the council told us, and less than 0.25% of the 2024-25 rates increase, though none of that made the news. Now, the cost of those speed bumps and cycleways was not really the focus of the Minister Simeon Brown's three-year, $33 billion transport plan announced this week, but the congestion they supposedly caused was. And the morning after, Heather Duplessy-Allen claimed that Simeon Brown had been hailed as golden balls by his colleagues, her Wellington Morning's colleague Nick Mills followed suit.
This is a ballsy move from Simeon. A golden ballsy move. But I know damn well people in Wellington region will agree with reducing spend on cycleways and increase the speed on cars because the cycleways slow them down.
Almost nowhere is it true, though, that cycle lanes once built slow traffic down. Cycles on the road among the cars do, though, as do the extra cars on the road that the cycle lanes can take away. It's really the roadside parking spots that drive opposition to cycle lanes, even in places where parking buildings are pretty plentiful. And while Nick Mills insisted, without evidence, that Wellingtonians would be thrilled with the minister's new $33 billion plan, he also said in the same breath a lot of the big-ticket items in it were existing projects, like a second tunnel for cars through Mount Victoria to the airport. And there was no mention of that 4-kilometre underground tunnel towards the airport that Simeon Brown had dangled in front of motorists in the capital last year. So what evidence also is there that the plan would actually reduce congestion, speed up travel, and in the end, pump up our productivity? Well, none, according to the Herald's writer Simon Wilson on Morning Report on RNZ National last Tuesday.
There is no evidence that the solutions they've proposed, building more major roads, which are going to take a long time, will achieve those goals. But if they had a plan to take cars off the roads by getting more people on public transport that works and is efficient and functional, if they had a plan to take some of the freight trucks off the road with rail, then they would achieve those goals. But this plan cuts the money that is available in those areas.
There, Simon Wilson was speaking as a citizen of the super city, which stands to snaffle by far the biggest bit of the $33 billion budget for the National Land Transport Plan. But not so in the South Island, where Newsroom's reporter David Williams said that claims that increasing the southern motorway speed would boost economic productivity had been rubbished by the experts. And then there's the question, where will that $33 billion of road-focused national land transport funding actually come from, and what would it pay for? On Tuesday, it dawned on Newstalk ZB's guy in Wellington, Nick Mills, that if funding for Wellington's unfinished cycle routes ends up drying up, people will still pay for it in their rates.
Those temporary cycleways that look like ugly, ugly things that everyone keeps telling us they're going to be replaced and fixed, where do we get the money from if the council are hell-bent on carrying on with these? Where do we get the money from? You guessed it. Hello, you just worked it out. Me and you. And the dog that was sitting on the back of that cycleway doesn't have to pay for a damn thing. He just gets to have a free ride. Not fair.
And at a national level, Morning Report's Corin Dan on Tuesday made this point to the minister about the bills to be paid by taxpayers.
How can you afford this? Because this isn't being paid for with the road user charges, with the petrol tax excise, with the motor vehicle registrations. You're having to top it up. So it isn't affordable, is it?
Well, those decisions were made as part of when the government policy statement on transport was aligned. Ultimately, we've got a huge infrastructure deficit as a country.
On his site for subscribers, Politic, the veteran political journalist Richard Harman also drilled down into that. Road users, through road user charges, fuel taxes and registration fees, will provide just under $14 billion of that, he said. Local government, another $6 billion odd, and taxpayers will pay another $13 billion on top of that over the next 3 years to the New Zealand Transport Authority, Waka Kotahi. But what happens if road construction costs inflate beyond the budget built in? Well, Richard Harman pointed out that the government already faces a squeeze on its operating allowance for next year's budget, and NZTA officials were already warning about that possibility this very week. The following day, the Herald's Thomas Coughlin reported that the government has what he called a hospital-sized hole in its transport plan, one that those applauding the back-on-track policy seem not to be aware of. Thomas Coughlin said it's hard to see, beyond hiking fuel taxes and road user charges even more, how the government can make the transport plan add up in the 2030s without further billions from the Crown. The simple problem, according to Thomas Coughlin, is that road users are no longer paying for the transport system, which is now heavily subsidised from the pool of money actually intended for the likes of schools and hospitals. By the end of the decade, net revenue is expected to be $6 billion a year, said Thomas Coughlin, but NZTA's costs are anticipated to be $12 billion a year, and that despite big fuel tax and road user tax hikes towards the end of the decade. If road users are unwilling to pay higher costs for some of the costliest parts of the transport network, Thomas Coughlin concluded, policymakers need to ask now whether those things are worth building in the first place. And others in the media could also be highlighting that for their audiences, as much as the puny costs of cycleways and speed bumps, which the minister was so keen to point to when launching his big plan. Well, as we've just heard, savings from scrapping speed bumps and cycleways won't cover much of the big bills for the government's new land transport plan, though that wasn't the focus of much media coverage. Hayden Donnell now looks at a reported cost-cutting measure in our hospitals that's now off the table after a rapid U-turn prompted in part by angry headlines about penny pinching.
I liken us to GPs to being like frogs in a boiling pot. The heat's gone up over years and years, but we haven't quite recognised how critical it's become until it's kind of too late.
That's Paula Matheson, owner of Whangarei's Rata Family Health, speaking to TVNZ's Breakfast early this year about a crisis in our health system, but she may as well have been talking at any point in the last 10 months. Headlines about our amphibian health system getting stewed in a steaming pot have bubbled up regularly over that span. This one's from March 7.
Doctors fear GP system is on brink of collapse.
This one's from April 4.
Health crisis persists for people with intellectual disabilities.
This one's from May 2.
Critical condition of emergency departments harming whole health system.
This one's from June 11.
Tragedies will happen, warn nurses over lack of staff.
And this one's from August 12.
Patients will die, GPs dire warning.
I could go on, but you get the picture. Just this week, there was another sign that the vessel cooking our health system has become a roiling cauldron, with NZME's new investigative hire, Michael Morrow, reporting on desperate patients lining up outside an Ōtara GP clinic from 6 a.m.
Why are you lined up so early this morning?
So the wait times are ridiculous. So if we come after, say, 9 or 10, then you're looking at like a 5-hour wait. And my dad's sick, so it's easier for me to come pull him in line and he just come see the doctors, and he's already in the waiting list.
So you're here on behalf of your dad?
I'm here on behalf of my dad.
All these stories were meticulously investigated and researched. They were well promoted by the outlets that published them, but few of them got the cut through of a single post written by a new dad on the Facebook page Vic Deals late last week. He said his partner wasn't given toast after giving birth at Wellington Regional Hospital, with staff apparently telling him their bread supplies had been cut off due to cost cutting. That post was picked up by the Herald's Wellington reporter Georgina Campbell last Friday, and her story promptly generated some less than positive feedback from our commentariat.
But I do believe that it's important to give the woman that have just given birth whatever they want.
That was News Talk ZB's Wellington host Nick Mills, but he wasn't alone. Comment sections filled up, talkback boards lit up, and then the health minister was confronted on the issue by News Talk's breakfast host Mike Hosking.
How is it I'm watching the news last night and we're having a debate about toast and pregnant women, and how has it got so bad that toast is a debate?
I completely agree with you. These are adult women who can make choices. And furthermore, toast is an easy comfort food after having a baby. So as I expressed, to Healthy Zen, seriously reconsider your position on this. Makes no sense to me.
Needless to say, the toast ban didn't last long.
Mai Hoki Mai, welcome back. Hospitals in the Wellington region have made a swift U-turn on the decision to stop providing toast and spreads to mothers after giving birth. Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand says the move was not because of cost cutting, and toast is now back on the menu while it works through meal changes.
That's One News last Sunday. It's still interesting seeing the apparent unravelling of our primary care system getting eclipsed by some absent bread. Perhaps that's because it's not just bread. As RNZ reported, something miraculous appears to happen to toast in the aftermath of birth. Its reporter Serena Solomon canvassed mums, dietitians and clinicians, all of whom explained in their own ways that in a post-birth context, toast becomes the ultimate fine dining experience. That sentiment was echoed by Finance Minister Nicola Willis on RNZ's First Up.
It just drove me absolutely mad, because I just remember viscerally that first cup of milky tea and Vegemite on toast after we delivered our first baby at Wellington Hospital. And I remember being so grateful for that toast. It was like a gourmet meal.
And over on News Talk ZB in Wellington, Nick Mills was getting the same message in his studio.
And do you know what? It was the worst piece of toast I've ever had in my life, while also being the best piece of toast I've ever had in my life. The toast was phenomenal, and exactly what I wanted without realising I wanted, even though it was, like, you know, not a good piece of toast. It was dry and it was thin and I don't even know what it had. I wouldn't even remember what it had on it, but it hit the spot.
Perhaps the apparent meanness of taking that experience away from new mothers helped crystallise the health system's issues in a way few sombre interviews could. As a letter writer put it to the New Zealand Herald,
"The spectre of Scrooge was hovering over Wellington Regional Hospital when they decided to stop offering toast and spreads to women who'd just given birth."
But maybe the story also got so big partly because it's so small. The structural macro problems in our country can feel a bit overwhelming at times. You need some toast and a Milo just thinking about them. It's hard to know where to begin, but toast. Toast is something you can handle. Toast you can fix in a hurry. And if you can fix that, maybe you can start asking questions like, how do we stop this sort of thing happening again? How do we get our hospitals enough bread to get some bread and spreads in the maternity ward? When it comes to approaching the huge problems, sometimes it's the little things that count.
Hayden Donnell there on how Toastgate played out in our media this past week. Hayden Donnell on how Toastgate played out in our media this past week. Well, that's all from us for Media Watch this weekend. Thanks for listening. Hayden will be back with Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday, and then we'll be back again with Media Watch, as usual, next weekend. Follow Media Watch and listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you have any thoughts to share with us or ideas for us to follow up, get in touch. Email us, mediawatch@rnz.co.nz, or you'll find us at MediaWatchNZ on X. And you can even write us an old-fashioned letter and send it to PO Box 123 Wellington. That's all from us for now. Ka kite. Catch you again for Midweek Media Watch on Wednesday night.